This is Sending Signals, a show about music and creativity. I'm your host, Matt Royal. Welcome to the show. My guest this week, Nidjur. Nidjur is best known as a solo artist, longtime frontman of Ultravox, and for his charity work, particularly with regard to Live Aid and associated projects. He's had a fascinating history. He was approached as a potential frontman for what had become the Sex Pistols. He was briefly a 70s teen pop star, having a number one single with the band Slick called Forever and Ever, which knocked Mamma Mia off a top spot in February 1976. He became friends with Phil Lynott and ended up touring with Thin Lizzy for a while, and co-writing Phil's solo hit Yellow Pearl, which became the theme of Top of the Pops for years. Of course, he enjoyed phenomenal success with Ultravox and as a solo artist. Today, Midge keeps very busy. He's preparing to go on tour in 2022. The tour is called Voice and Visions and will focus on Ultravox's two albums from 1981, Rage in Eden and Quartet. Midge also appears on the new Slinky Vagabond album, and he reveals during our interview that he has three new albums in the pipeline. We also talk about his forthcoming photo book in a picture frame and his new single with Band Electronica, Das Beat. Midge was great company, and I hope you enjoy our chat. You can find me on Twitter at Signals Podcast and on Instagram at Sending Signals Podcast. Here's my conversation with Nidjur.
Hello.
Hello.
Oh, hold on. Are you not seeing me? There we go. There I am. There we go.
You're very purple.
How are you doing?
I'm okay. How are you?
You've got an Aston mic.
An Aston mic, yeah.
Yes. See, there you go. I've got one similar somewhere.
Do you like it?
Yeah, they're very good. Yeah, they're really good. They're really robust, really well made, and they sound great. So what's not to like? It's good.
Where are you calling from, mate?
I live in Bath, so this is my little box of a studio in here. Down the southwest.
Ah, okay. Ah, oh, very nice. I'm in Southend.
Southend. Oh, Cliffs Pavilion.
Correct. I was going to say we have met before. Like very briefly, because when Ultravox came,
10 years ago or whatever.
Yeah, it would have been about that. Yeah, Yeah. I think you're back at the Cliffs. I think next year.
Yes, doing the Voice and Visions tour.
Yeah,
yeah, it's a great place. It's funny. It's when you're walking up the hill towards it and you see it in the distance. It kind of looks as though it belongs in Miami in the 1950s. The building. With the sign and the clock and all of that stuff. It's fantastic.
I guess you've got there's a lot going on because you've got a Voice and Visions tour. You've got a photography book coming out. And you're on the new Slinky Vagabond album as well, aren't you?
I am, yes. Yeah, I did a couple of tracks on that.
Before we talk about Voice and Visions, I wanted to ask about the tour you've just done, which you didn't get to finish because you were playing Vienna in full. On that, weren't
yep.
you?
Yep.
What did you learn about Vienna as an album from playing it in full? Yeah, what did you discover about it by like going back and sort of forensically having to recreate it and playing it as a piece each night?
It's funny, I probably spent more time analysing it and looking at it in the last couple of years than I ever did at the time. Because at the time, you're kind of thrust into something, you know. You're the new kid on the block. You're the new guy in the band. And you have to kind of watch your P's and Q's. You have to watch what you're saying or which direction you want things to go in. And I was like, you know, these guys had been doing this together as a unit for quite a while. You know, using electronics, and they knew more about synthesis than I ever did. So I was kind of there learning. So I didn't really raise my head that much. But like any album, you know, we had limited time, we had limited budgets. But I think you go back and you look at it, you know, 40 years later, and you think, okay, well, I'm not quite sure, you know, about the lyrics in some of it. I can't quite remember what I was thinking when I was doing some of them. A lot of the lyrics on the VN album were written by Warren, the drummer, because it was something that he had always really wanted to do within the band, and he was very good at it. So going back and looking at it again, thinking, okay, well, I wouldn't necessarily have written that type of lyric, but maybe it wouldn't have been the same track if I'd changed the lyrics or I had more input in it or whatever. It might have gone off and deviated a little bit from the rest of it. The thing that sounds right to me about the album is it's coherent. You know, there was an experimentation going on. There was a freshness to it because, you know, like any band, you take two members out and shove a new member in. You know, it resets the balance a little bit. It alters the balance. And we were trying to find our feet as a four piece. You know, we had previous Ultravox and previous me to kind of build on, but nobody really knew what that was going to sound like and what how that was going to form, you know, over the length of writing that album. So I think looking back at something that didn't cost an awful lot to make, was made in 3 weeks from start to finish, was written and toured on the road before we even got near the studio, old style, and using the basic technology we had, I think we did an amazing job.
It still sounds phenomenal. I was listening to it earlier in the week, I guess, and it's just like, this is just, it's great. You know, I think you said that maybe it makes, or maybe it's more understood now than it was at the time. Like, I think you said it's kind of a weird proposition. There's this, it's kind of like, it's sort of electronic, but there's a violinist and... yeah,
and there's guitar all over. people choose not to hear the guitar, which is odd, you know, because it's everywhere. So on most of the tracks, it's funny that John Taylor from Duran spoke to me a couple of years ago. They were making a new album in London, and I bumped into him in Bath, and he said, we were playing your album the other day. We were playing Vienna the other day, just to get a vibe and just. Just to, you know, because we're looking at kind of 80s influences and stuff, and he said, I don't know how you did it. He said, but there's a looseness to it. And I said, that's because we played everything live. Nothing was sequenced, nothing was programmed. So there's a human element to that record. A bit like you listen to Kraftwerk records and the drums have got a feel, you know, it's meant to be robotic, but there's an absolute human feel to it because it's played by humans. It's not pressing buttons on a computer or whatever. It's not really rigid and banging time. And the whole Vienna album's like that, you know, because we didn't have the technology to make one synthesizer talk to one drum machine or, you know, two synthesizers to lock together.
Yeah, it's not all MIDI controlled. It's loose.
And it's human. And that's a key to it, I think, that still makes it stand up today.
I guess I got really into you guys around the time that Brilliant came out. You know, it was such a good move, I think, putting out a new album because it gave you credibility. And so for me, I guess I was in my, I don't know, like late 20s or something. And yeah, you had a new album out, which was great. You know, it was a really strong album. And so being able to see Ultravox touring a new album, it gave it credibility. And I was baffled actually because I saw you twice. I saw you in Southend, which was full on Brilliant tour. I think you might have done two sets. It was a long show. And then I saw your last ever show, which was supporting Simple Minds.
Yeah.
And I was baffled by the O2 show because you did nothing off of Brilliant. You just did a set of old songs. And I was like, and it was a great set. I like really enjoyed it. But it was also a bit like, oh, come on, guys. You can't have given up on this new album already.
it wasn't a case of that. When you're doing an opening slot for someone else, you've got 45, 50 minutes or something to get across to an audience that isn't yours.
Yeah.
And also you want to give Simple Minds, you know, keep them on their toes. So, you know, Ultravox had a lot of hits. So we just kind of crammed it full of all the kind of hit songs. And of course, you saw it. So, you know, you're very limited to what you get. You don't get the full PA and you don't get the full light rig, and because you don't want to, you know, detract from the main band. That's kind of what you do.
Yeah.
So I came up with the idea of, well, we'll only use white lights. So our entire set was moody. It's only lit by white lights, except for the violin solo in Vienna, where we had a blue backdrop. You've got to kind of use the tools that you've given to make the most of what you have. And it would have been the wrong environment to go on here. It would have been one of those classic tumbleweed moments, you know, when you say, and here's something from the new album. And you can hear the crowd just go, ooh, you know, just die in front of you, because they wouldn't have known it, you know, whereas playing new material in front of an audience who've come to see Ultravox and Ultravox only is a whole different ballgame.
Yeah, that was a side point to what I was getting to. But so I think if you see, you know, Ultravox live, you as a guitarist, you know, there are moments where it's like, you know, you really realise like Midge is a guitar player. There's an energy to your playing, and maybe that comes through live, perhaps more than on record, maybe. But I wondered if you had to rein in your guitar instincts when you joined Ultravox. I mean, you toured with Thin Lizzy as a guitarist. You must have been a pretty great guitar player at the time. And so, as you say, like, guitar is not the main thing that comes across when you listen to Vienna. So did you have to rein yourself in, like, a bit? Or were you very good at serving the song? Did you have the same vision as...
I think that the vision was shared. And I think that there are moments when the guitar was allowed to shine and do its thing. You listen to All Stood Still from that album. There's guitar solos and whatever on there. There's guitar all over. It's a very guitar-oriented guitar riff, you know. So it was a matter of, as I say, trying to find our feet. What are we and where are we? And, you know, I was doing a lot of rhythmic stuff on that album, because it was something that Ultravox had been doing, the very kind of choppy rhythmic guitar stuff. So it was more percussive than solo led. But you've got to remember, you know, I bought a synthesizer in 1978 and I joined Ultravox in 1979. So I was still new with this piece of electronic machinery. I was still dabbling with that. And I found that maybe at the time a bit more interesting than just getting up there and playing guitar solos. But it seemed to merge. It was getting the balance right between, you know, what people perceived you as, and people perceived Ultravox as a synthesizer band. But as you quite rightly pointed out, you see Ultravox and there's a violin player in there, and there's a guy banging the hell out of a drum kit, and there's a bass player playing bass guitar. You know, they were a punk band back in 1977. So it's you know, proper instrumentation. All the instrumentation was fair game to Ultravox, you know, so it didn't really matter to us what it was, creating a kind of unique sound, whether people loved it or loathed it, was kind of important to us. We didn't want to sound like everybody else. And I don't think we did.
Yeah. Has it been challenging for you being a replacement singer in a band? And although, again, Ultravox were far more successful with you as a front man than with your predecessor, but I mean, for me, I'm into Genesis and Marillion, you know, two bands that have got former singers that were only with them for a short while. But even now, the sort of shadow of that still causes issues in the fan base and for the band. And I'm guessing there's still probably a John Fox Ultravox contingent out there who love that stuff. And has that been a challenge for you to navigate? Was it a challenge in 1980? Did it continue to be a challenge?
I think maybe the initial shows that we did when the Vienna album just came out at first, we did a handful of shows, and I was very conscious that, you know, a lot of Ultravox fans were there, you know, who were waiting to see me, you know, and you know, basically hold up cards with marks out of 10, you know, so nil point for you on this one. Thank you very much. You know, and also, you know, when we did those initial shows, we were still performing. We were performing some of the old Ultravox material. So I was singing like Quiet Man and Hiroshima Mon Amour and My Sex, and, you know, because we didn't have enough material to do a full set. So how horrific must that have been for, you know, a hardcore fan to see this Scottish guy coming up there and singing, you know, their hero's work. But weirdly, John was in the audience and by all accounts, gave it the kind of thumbs up. It's just lovely. But other than that, there was no question of trying to fit in anybody else's shoes. You join a unit, and then that unit goes off, just naturally goes off a tangent. It goes off from the track that was already on, simply because the balance is different. So we found our own peculiar path quite quickly.
Yeah. So this time you're doing selections from Rage in Eden and Quartet.
Yeah.
Did you consider playing Rage in full? Did you consider that?
I think I'm still looking at it all. I think Quartet's the one I might be having problems with about playing in full. Because originally, when I did the 1980 tour, it was going to be the full Vienna and the full First Visage album. And then I listened to it again, and I just thought, I can't pay service to something that I don't quite understand anymore. Because there's certain tracks that just didn't work for me anymore. And I think I'm going to have the same problem, certainly with some of the stuff on Quartet. Rage in Eden, I think, might be easier, because I'm very proud of that record. But I'll tell you in a few months' time when I've actually sat down and figured out what it is I do want to play. But the essence of the show will be based around both those albums. So far, I haven't found anything that's an absolute no.
So have you started rehearsals for it yet?
No, I've started looking at creating sounds. There's a lot of prep work involved. In getting programming synth sounds. I want to get synth sounds that have the same essence. Maybe not, I'm not trying to replicate them, but I'm trying to get them to do the same thing as well as the original sounds did, so there's an authenticity to it. And that takes a long time. And you can't sit here for days on end just making synth sounds, because you go crazy. It's like a torture of some description. So you have to take, you know, every other week I'll find another song and start working on the sounds for that and whatever. So that's where I am right now. Rehearsals won't really start until about January.
Yeah. Well, what you could do is you could tour with Ultravox, and then they could worry about the synth.
No, it took to do that tour. Ultravox, it took 8 weeks. 8 weeks of rehearsals before we'd played 2.5 weeks of shows, because, you know, some of the band hadn't performed for, you know, 30 years, and they hadn't used the modern technology. They hadn't used any of monitors. They hadn't used any of that stuff. So it took a long time to get up to speed as a band, you know, because we wanted to do it really well. It wasn't a cash run, believe me. It wasn't a bank raid by any stretch of the imagination.
Do you view it as a success, like the tour and the brilliant album and that time period? Do you look at it as going as that was a good thing to do? It was great. It's a success. I'm proud of it. It's a happy time. Or is it more complicated than that?
No, it wasn't more complicated than that. It was really quite basic. We I don't think any of us thought that we'd all think the same way again. You know, why would we ever want to go out there and put our necks in that noose again? But we did. We all felt the same way at the same time. Mm. So it felt like a great way of tying up loose ends. It felt a great way of reconnecting with people that you know, if you're with a partner and you split, you know, it's somewhere down the line you're going to start blaming each other. You know, that's what happens. So, and a band's no different. We'll all point fingers and go, well, it was his fault, and it was his fault, and this is what happened, and whatever. It happened. It fell apart. It crumbled, and you move away, and then you're not in touch anymore. So it was a nice way of kind of coming back together and tying up those personal loose ends and reconnecting with people who were your, you know, your bosom buddies, your partners in music for, you know, 5 or 6 years, whatever it was. So that was a massive success. And then the fact that we ended up making a new album. I mean, who would have thought ever that, you know, people who hadn't been in the same room together for 25 years might still have something artistic to say as a unit. And we did. I'm very proud of the Brilliant album as well. I think it worked unbelievably well.
It's really good.
It had all the trademarks and all the essence of old Ultravox, but with something new and a bit different in there.
So the photography book, as I understand it, it's kind of photographs. Is it from 1980 to 85?
Around then, yeah. When I joined Ultravox, Chris and Warren already had 35mm cameras, and I had never held a 35mm camera, and I was fascinated by these things. So when I first made any kind of money, got an advance or whatever, I bought myself a camera. And because we were we were very reticent of having photographers and journalists travel with us, because certainly at that time, you were more stitched up more often than helped by that. So we just avoided the whole thing. So we ended up taking photographs backstage, all this, the whole, you know, whatever we did, you know, writing lyrics, going off on trips to do whatever, you know, making videos. We were documenting all of that. And then I paid absolutely no attention. You see the photographs and you go, that's nice. And you put them away somewhere. Then they're in an outbuilding. Then they get wet. Then they're all stuck together. Then they're all scratched and whatever. So when I found these photographs, a couple of people very, very kindly kind of digitized them and cleaned them all up for me. And then I started going through them again on a computer. And I thought that it's amazing. It's not just telling stories of what it was like backstage or what it was like back then. But things have changed so much since those photographs were taken. Technology, cars, clothes, you know, fashion, attitudes. And they're all captured in these photographs. So there's a great shot of me with Ultravox in America. It must be like 1981 or whatever. And the cars look like an old movie. It's just these big boxy things, massive cars parked in the street. And you think, I've captured that moment in time, or when we're touring Japan and I've taken a photograph during the sound check from the back of the stage showing all the equipment from the point of view that I would have behind synthesizers. And the synthesizers are so unbelievably basic. But, you know, again, you wouldn't take a photograph of that, to, you know, as a keepsake. But when you look back at it, it's little moments in time, little nuggets that you think, OK, this is of interest, I think.
It's so interesting, the idea of like photographs versus memories, because I guess they're both as unreliable as each other in a way. You know, like a photograph isn't going to 100% reflect the actual colours that you saw at the time. And you don't know what's just out of frame, and you don't know how the fact that a photograph was taken has influenced what is within the frame as well. And so It's very interesting. Did you find that it was affecting your memories of certain things, that things were different to how you remembered them, or that certain memories became more crystallized? How did it sort of balance with your recollections of that time?
I think memories are human, and humans err. You know, when I did my autobiography many years ago, I opened it up by saying, these are my recollections. You know, if you're in a room with 100 people and an incident happens, you're going to get 100 stories, 100 versions of what happened. So to remember things, the memories color and change and alter and embellish and whatever. But a photograph doesn't really. Yes, it doesn't give you the true colors of what you're seeing. It doesn't show you what's happening outside the frame. But you cannot deny that what's in the frame was there. That was it. That was that moment in time. You've captured that, and nobody can alter it. You can maybe argue about what the story was, you know, what was actually happening in that photograph. And that's a gray area. If I say this is worn on a cart in an airport, and I think the airport was in Munich, you know, it's quite right that Chris would say, no, I remember that happening, but it was in Dusseldorf. So you're never 100% sure, because we all have these malleable thoughts and memories, and sometimes adjust them to suit whatever you're trying to do. I think photographs are slightly more reliable.
Good answer. I And I find it fascinating when I think about some of the sort of the big bands, say like the obvious, the Beatles, the Stones, what it must be like for them to have so much of their lives documented, you know. And when, I mean, obviously, like now with camera phones, the current generation is going to have their lives meticulously documented. That's how it is now. But for like my parents or grandparents' generation, so much is just lost. You know, they may have some photographs that were taken when they bought a roll of film or from certain special events. But I think musicians are in a really interesting situation in that so much of your life has been documented by others, and that what you did for a job, which happened to be creating art, the art still exists and is living and is there, and you're able to like visit earlier versions of yourself with much more clarity than the average person of your age can.
Yeah, I suppose that's a case. I mean, I suppose the big difference is that, you know, future generations, you know, will look back at current generations and know exactly what they had for breakfast and lunch and dinner, because it's all documented.
Yeah.
You know, at least that side of what we were doing wasn't. It was mainly, you know, music. It was mainly, you know, interviews. My brother-in-law is a famous music journalist, and he has a site that digs out all the old interviews, and every so often he sends one to me and I cringe. I sit there thinking, oh my God, I thought I was smarter than that. And I obviously wasn't. So it's weird having bits of history that are actual thrown back at you many years later.
Yeah.
Because my perception of who and what I was back then is radically different from the reality. It's strange that everything has been documented and it's all accessible. You know, everything will be accessible at some point. But I'm glad to say there's still some dark holes back there that you know, people just don't get. You know, we were selective about which photographs we used.
Did you ever wish you'd taken the Sex Pistols job?
No, not at all. It was, you know, they weren't known as the Sex Pistols at the time, because that's not what they said to me. I don't know what I would have done in the Sex Pistols. I had a perfectly good time with the Rich Kids, thank you very much. Who knows? You know, again, nothing I've ever done in life has been planned. You know, things happen and you make a decision and you go off, you know, one way or the other. And the route that I've taken has kept me incredibly entertained. You know, the highs and lows and the rough parts and the good parts. Even the bad bits were good. But had I done something different in the beginning, I might have ended up in a totally different place. So I'm quite happy with the route that I took.
How did you get to know Phil Lynott?
I was a fan of Skid Row as an aspiring guitar player in Glasgow. I went to see a very young Skid Row with a 16-year-old Gary Moore playing guitar. Mm. And he was exceptional. I mean, exceptional. And then I read an article about another band that had a former member of Skid Row in it, Phil Lynott, and his new band, Thin Lizzy. And I went to see them. And Phil's voice and delivery and style and the band themselves. It was when Ireland were just coming up with great three-piece rock bands. And they were just brilliant. And I got to know Philip. I met him in Glasgow. And then when I moved to London to join the Rich Kids, I bumped into him in an underground. I was coming out. He was going in. And I said, I don't think you remember me. And he said, yeah, that kid from Glasgow. And that was it. We were mates. We just hung out. So that when I was doing the finishing touches to the... I put the finishing production touches to the first Visage album. I got the phone call from Philip saying, Gary's not in the band anymore. We're on tour with Journey. You know, can you come out and finish the tour? I'd never been to America and I'd joined Ultravox. So I said, well, I'm, you know, yeah. how cool's that? Yeah, of course, I'll have a crack at that. That'd be great.
So how did the sort of Dave Flett thing happen then? Because you were moved on to keyboards during the tour. So like, was that like a bit of a blow for you?
No. I was the glue that was holding it together. So I did the tour of America. That was it. Initially, it was just America. And I was going back to Ultravox to finish off the Vienna album. Then they got in touch with me because we ended up with the same management as Thin Lizzy. Then they came back and said, look, we're still looking for a guitarist. We've been auditioning people and we've got this guy. you know, but we'd like you to come out to Japan to do the tour. And Phil was pretty enamored, I think, with the keyboards, because while we were in America, I would play him bits of magazine or bits of, you know, Ultravox or bits of cassette recordings of what we were actually working on. And he quite got into this. I think he always liked to a little bit of whatever was happening to be involved in his life. So I went to Japan with them, relegated to keyboards up the back, Thin Lizzy with keyboards. It should never really happen, should it? And while they tried out Dave Flett, and then at the end of each set, I would come off the keyboards and play the last six songs or something up front.
Oh, really?
And then they asked me to come out and do the Irish tour when Dave Flett didn't work out, while they were trying out Snowy White. So I was there. I was like the middleman. I should have been the agent or something.
Amazing. I was wondering how much other music influences you when creating music. Are you as influenced by, you know, film or photography or the geography of where you are, like as much as music? How does that work for you when you're getting inspired to create?
Well, there's no one born who just pops out the womb and instantly creates something that's new and fresh. You only create something because you're influenced by someone else you've seen or heard or experienced. And that hopefully never goes away, that you're constantly influenced by, you know, bits and pieces you hear, you know, a snippet of music on a film or a snippet of music on an advert or whatever. The past 18 months, I've been working on three separate albums. I've been working on the album that I'm always working on, which is the new official album that's been going on for years now. I also started working on a follow-up to the orchestrated album. I did an orchestrated album 2 or 3 years ago. And I discovered that just about everything I've ever been involved in could be orchestrated, because it's all very dramatic and cinematic. At the beginning of this year, Scala Radio, new classical station, asked me to host a late night radio show for them 5 nights a week, I think called Space, where they were playing, it's all instrumental music or choral music. And it's mainly classical. And I said, well, is it okay to play some things that I find interesting? And they said, yeah, of course. So I started slipping in some of the kind of neoclassical musicians that are coming out of Germany and, you know, Iceland. It seems to be full of them. For a country that's got very few people, most of them seem to be writing brilliant music. So, you know, Ulfar Arnolds and, you know, Sigur Rós and all of that stuff. So I started integrating all this textural, ambient, filmic thing. And it totally sparked me to go and delve into that world again. You know, just about every album I've ever been associated with has had instrumental tracks. So I've just finished an entire album of instrumental music.
Ooh.
All inspired by just listening to something that doesn't have lyrics, by listening to other people creating music, you know, going all the way back to when I first bought a synthesizer because I heard music for films by, you know, Brian Eno, or music for airports, or, you know, just textural ambient music. So I've delved into that.
It's been an amazing year as well for instrumental music. Like, some of my favourite records this year have been in that vein. The Hannah Peel album, Fur Wave, is phenomenal. The Floating Points, Pharoah Sanders record, have you heard that?
No.
So Floating Points done an album with Pharoah Sanders, the legendary jazz guy, with the LSO as well. I think it's called Promises. And it's basically like a long suite of songs. It's all based around this one theme. It is jaw-droppingly good. I cannot recommend it enough. Please check it out. I guarantee you'll love it. That and the Hannah Peel album been two of my favorites this year. And what else? There's an Indian lady called Arusha Jain who's done an album based on like Hindustani ragas but played on modular synthesizers.
Wow.
And that is that's a bit out of my comfort zone, but like a wonderful, like immersive record. So it's
I think people are looking for something else. They're looking for something other than the 3 minute, you know, well sculpted by, you know, 20 different writers, you know, pop songs. It's a lot of stuff, and it's an age old gripe, that the old musician moaning about the new stuff. But it's become very homogenized, unless it's radical, unless there's something absolutely radical out there, you know, drill or whatever. It just seems kind of stale. Certainly radio feels very stale. And maybe radio is not the medium that people use for music anymore.
I don't listen to radio, basically. Yeah. And so for me, music's really exciting, but it's because I seek out stuff that I... And yeah, to me, I just think music is amazingly exciting, but there's so much of it.
It's a bit like Bitcoin. You have to go out there mining for good music. So, because you're right, there is so much of it, because there's no filtration system anymore. You know, everyone can do something on the laptop. Everyone's got the software, and it's the people with the ideas that will come up with something interesting. But you have to really look for it.
And bands can be huge, but still be kind of like bands like The National, who can headline arenas, play huge shows, but the man on the street doesn't know who The National are. That's a really weird situation. You know, Arcade Fire can headline Glastonbury. But again, like, they're not particularly, you know, you ask the average person to name an Arcade Fire song. So the industry is so different now. And so in some ways that's exciting, because it means there isn't this monoculture that's getting fed to you. But potentially, if you're not looking deeply, like, as you say, everything seems... Yeah, like, I mean, commercial radio is just dire, and so there's a lot of problems in the industry, and what the monoculture is talent shows, which doesn't excite me, and not that there's no value to it, but it doesn't do anything for me. And so and I guess for you, although it must be tricky for you sometimes, like, at least you've got an established audience to work with, which means that you can you've always got that fan base to sort of rely on. But if you're starting out now,
we all have the vehicle now. It's not some elitist thing where you have to be signed and spotted and, you know, headhunted and, you know, all of that stuff. You know, as I said, the facilities are there for people to express themselves. It's just how you find the ears that are going to hear it. That's all.
Thank you for talking, mate. Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you want to talk about?
The only thing you haven't mentioned, there's a new single out today.
Wow. Tell me about it.
There's a single. When I was touring Germany with the 1980 tour with Band Electronica, we got to Düsseldorf, the home of, you know, electronic music. Wolfgang Fleur is one of the original percussionists.
He's supposed to be coming on the podcast, but not until he's...
I'm sure he'll do it. He's a lovely, lovely man.
I'm just waiting for his album to come out, yeah.
Right, well, this track's on his album. He came to the show, and afterwards he said, look, I'm working on a project, but, you know, I'd love to write something, or you to write something for me, or whatever. And we talked about it, and a couple of days later, when I was traveling around Germany in the tour bus, I came up with the idea that you know, music itself, you know, it connects the world together. But the beats, the rhythms, the drums is something that we all have. You know, it's a basic instrument that every culture on the planet, you know, uses. And I thought of him being this electronic percussionist, and I came up with a song called Das Beat. You know, the beat in German, and I came home and I wrote the song and I sent it to him, and he said, that's great, love it. And then he changed it all. he took bits off and put other bits in, and, you know, did his interpretation of it, which is great. But I said, look, I want to do my interpretation, so I'll do one version and you do another version. His version is on his album, which is coming out soon. And my version was released today of Das Beat, and it's a nod of respect and, you know, thanks to all those brilliant people who used incredibly basic synthesis and made the inspiration that sparked us all off, you know, made us all want to go and buy something that lights up and makes funny noises. And it's very steeped in that whole 80s thing. So yeah, it's very odd thinking, wow, how odd, you know, that I've got a track out today, but I don't have anything physical in my hand. Yeah. There's no 7-inch single. It's all up there in ether world. So it's interesting to experience.
Thanks for doing this, mate. It's been great.
It's a pleasure. It's been fun.
And that's our show. Thanks as always to our guests whose opinions are our own. Special thanks this week to Erica. Bye!